We've made it to a Thursday here on Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We're glad that you are with us today. Coming up a bit later in today's show, Dave Thompson sorts through the headlines in our weekly news review, then a powerful story from Harvest Public Media about how the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation is reclaiming ancestral land once promised and stolen. And finally, we'll go to the movies with Matt Olean. Matt picks up the movie Friendship and dives into suburban loneliness with equal parts awkward laughs and quiet heartbreak. Main Street begins today with a conversations on healthcare exploring a growing crisis. Nearly one in three high school students report persistent feelings of hopelessness. And in too many communities across the country and here in North Dakota, there simply aren't enough mental health professionals to help. But a new program, the Youth Mental Health Corps, is stepping up with a promising solution. Co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner of Conversations on Healthcare speak with two national leaders supporting this effort, Marie Groark of the Schultz Family Foundation and Elise Marshall of Pinterest, to discuss how placing trained young adults in schools and community organizations is making a measurable difference in youth mental health.
Marie and Elise, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great to be here today.
Well, let's begin with the overview of the problem. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports one in three high school students report persistent feelings of hopelessness. About 122 million people live in what's called mental health professional shortage areas, and the country needs over 6,000 mental health practitioners. Ray, I'm wondering if you could give our audience your foundation's perspective on the severity of these issues.
Yeah, at the Schultz Family Foundation, we believe in creating opportunity accessible to all, and we really focus on young people and their transition from adolescence to adulthood. And our work often focuses on those young people that aren't necessarily going right from high school to college to career, but those that might take a more circuitous path to economic mobility and prosperity. And about 3 years ago, when we started talking to our grantees just coming out of COVID, one of the things that we found was that many of our grantees who had training programs or mentorship programs or other types of supports for young people were having a hard time delivering their services because of the mental health challenges the young people they serve were facing. And we started to realize that if you care about young adults in this country and you want to support them in their education aspirations, in their career aspirations, it all goes through mental health. We can't ignore the mental health challenges facing our young people if we really care about them and their future. And so it was at that time we realized we needed to do something about this. Our co-chair, Sherry Schultz, really came up with the idea of, wait a minute, is it possible to pair national service with youth mental health? And so it was in this brainchild that we started to think maybe there was a way that we could address some of the issues you noted at the top about mental health provider deserts, the fact that so few young people are able to access the kind of care that they need, the fact that more young people need alternative pathways to graduate into a career, and that we could actually expand the availability of services for young people while also giving other young people a chance to explore and attain new careers. And so that's where how the Youth Mental Health Corps was born.
Well, at least we know that suicide is the second leading cause of death among 10 to 14-year-olds. So about a year ago, you and the others launched the Youth Mental Health Corps in response to this reality. Tell us today, how does the Corps actually work?
Yeah, so today, the Youth Mental Health Corps leverages the power of national service and AmeriCorps, and really bringing in young people themselves, so 18 to 25-year-olds, bringing them into schools and local community-based organizations and community-based health clinics to serve as youth mental health navigators for young people and their families and caregivers in local communities. At Pinterest, we recognize the importance of meeting young people where they are. While we are an online destination for so many young people, Gen Z, representing our fastest growing demographic of users of our over half billion users around the world. We also recognize the importance of collective action and partnering up with folks like the Schultz Family Foundation and other state and local leaders to really tackle this crisis head on. A few years ago, when the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy really called attention to the youth mental health crisis, some data came out showing that resources were really lacking where young people spent the majority of their time, in schools, in local communities. So when we were identifying solutions and ways that we could be a part of you know, helping to address this crisis, we knew that we would have to respond by making sure that we were keeping our online community of young people safe on our platform, but also extending that impact to show up in the communities where young people were in need of critical support and care. So we launched the Youth Mental Health Corps, and today we've got over 300 Youth Mental Health Corps members who are serving as mental health navigators in schools and community-based orgs.
Well, that's so great, Margaret. We were so happy to have the Surgeon General on.
Right.
Such a clarion call in this particular area. Lisa, I want to follow up. The Corps allows a participant to enter a mental health career path through one of three certification pathways. I wonder if you could just fill us in on each one of those pathways.
Yeah, so one of them is serving as a sort of peer navigator, community peer navigator. So actually, you know, certifying young people to be those community ambassadors and actually get training and additional skills through a range of pathways at the state and local level. So whether that's partnering with local communities, healthcare systems, or working with local community college systems to get that sort of peer-to-peer navigator apprenticeship skill set. And the other way that we're sort of powering up communities is through the mental health first aid training. So this is an evidence-based training that's been out there for some years and has a pretty solid evidence base to it. The Surgeon General and others have pointed to this as being one of those sort of best practices that schools and community-based organizations can begin implementing immediately. And then the other one is a community health worker model. This has been one of those models that has taken off. We've been working with an organization, WestEd, to actually look at case studies to understand what is working in communities where we have launched the Youth Mental Health Corps. And one of the states that has that community health worker model is Minnesota. So you'll learn more about that when we release those case studies later on in the year.
Well, and Marie, maybe I can just follow up. I understand the Corps also offers resources to help students navigate social challenges online, something the former Surgeon General was also very engaged in, such as harassment and bullying and bias. How do they do this? What does this look like? And is there research behind their approach, or is it a try, test, see how things work?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I feel like I'm going to start, but then I think I'll also hand it over to Elise because Pinterest has been such a leader in this space. But one of the things that we have found is we've gone out to visit with Youth Mental Health Corps members is they talk about the impact that social media is having on their experiences as early as elementary school. So, you know, a lot of young people have unfettered access to technology, and they begin to feel those effects, this idea of what's happening online, showing up for them at school, the anxiety that comes along with that, and really a dearth of resources available inside of schools to help young people have conversations about what's happening online, to be able to recognize, to not be shameful about that or feel shame about that, but to have a safe place to talk about it, and then to build skills to help them navigate that, personal skills and then real skills just in terms of, you know, how you set your social media settings to protect yourself. The other thing that we've heard is that there aren't a lot of resources in schools to have the conversations, and that we even have Youth Mental Health Corps members who have thought to themselves, like, wait a minute, I have a series of sort of skills that I use. And is there any way for me to adapt those for our young people? And while we appreciate the ambition of those Youth Mental Health Corps members, we also feel very strongly that we want to supply them with the training that they need to be able to have those really critical and important conversations with young people in middle and high schools. And so that's where Pinterest has really helped us understand what the right curriculum and approach is for that digital wellness conversation. And I don't know, Elise, if you want to fill in a little bit there.
Yeah, sure thing. So we have been sort of championing digital well-being in the industry for the last several years. Our CEO, it starts at the very top with our CEO, Bill Reddy, who has sort of made it table stakes for us to keep young people safe online, really all of our users safe online, but recognizing the importance of safeguarding our youngest users on this platform, but also extending that to call for the rest of the industry. So last year, or a couple of years ago, we launched something called the Inspired Internet Pledge with Boston Children's Hospital Digital Wellness Lab. This is a research institution that gathers experts and practitioners and leaders who are all looking at this intersection of youth well-being and digital well-being, especially with the advent of social media and technology. We recognize that innovation is not going to be slowing down, and it's going to be incumbent upon us, both on the industry side, to create the right types of guardrails and policies and practices to keep young people safe on the platform, but also to ensure we're arming young people and educators and parents and caregivers with all of the resources and supports that they need to navigate the online ecosystem safely. For a long time, Pinterest has been really popular for moms, for teachers. It's sort of the ultimate resource hub where you can come and get tips and best practices. So we hope to make a lot of that that material available on Pinterest very soon. And we're partnering with lots of other organizations in this space, like Common Sense Media, among others.
Elise, you just mentioned you wanted to keep people safe on the platform. Pinterest, of course, is a social media service, and you're helping to fund this effort. Is there any contradiction of sorts, and how do you view this relationship?
No, I think the two have to work hand in hand, right? Like, we have been, you know, sort of trying to think about what are the ways in which we can show up first as an industry leader. And then again, how can we encourage other industry leaders through things like the Inspired Internet Pledge to follow suit? One of the things that we've done is to protect the privacy of young people on our platform, setting all under 16-year-old profiles to private by default. Providing additional resources and guides to parents of young people on our platform with additional supports and resources as well. So the two have to work hand in hand, especially given how ubiquitous technology is a part of our lives now. Young people are using technology for everything. And so even communicating with some of their educators, right? Like, you ask the average student, how are they communicating with their educator, you know, in their classroom? A lot of them are using technology to do so. And so we think that, you know, it's really important that we not bury our heads in the sand on this, but that we think about how are we supporting and arming the next generation, but also holding up our commitment as industry leaders first.
Well, Elise, if I can, AmeriCorps and the Schultz Family Foundation joined with your company to start Youth Mental Health Corps. I guess one of the questions is why a need for a private company to get engaged, and what motivated your involvement? Was this already on your radar as something that you thought needed to happen?
Well, again, I think we were really moved. We felt a very, you know, being the fact that so many young people come to Pinterest and hearing from young people that, you know, being on Pinterest makes them feel both safe, makes them feel seen, right? Being able to find themselves in their communities on our platform and find, you know, inspiration for their lives. We felt a great responsibility to respond to some of what the data was bearing out in things like the Youth Risk Behavior Survey study that the CDC comes out with every couple of years, showing that Rates of anxiety, feelings of social isolation and depression were on the rise, particularly coming out of, you know, a historic pandemic that we were all navigating. So, you know, us being a, you know, large company with a large presence and influence in the lives of young people, we felt definitely a responsibility to ensure that we were responding to what that data was showing us, and that we weren't trying to address the full scale of this crisis that we know is deeply complex and intersecting on our own, that it would take a collective effort to do so accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just want to echo what Elise said about the power of the multi-sector partnerships, given the challenge that lies before us. This isn't a challenge that just a philanthropy can solve, or even a public sector system. It requires all of us working together and bringing the assets and expertise that each of us have to the table, and then crafting innovative solutions to address this challenge. One of the best parts about, I'd say, the Youth Mental Health Corps is the range of partners involved in it, whether it's the college systems at the state level, the state service commissions, governor's offices, schools, community-based organizations, as well as partners like Pinterest, the Schultz Family Foundation, Pivotal Ventures. There's so many of us gathered around the table, Starbucks. And as I think about that, oftentimes when you have many people gathered around a table, the partnership can become unwieldy. You spend more time managing your partners than you actually do working on the issue. I'd say in this case, that's actually not happening. And the reason for that is the clarity that we have in terms of the mission and the values that we bring to this. The challenges facing our young people, we're in an emergency situation, and we have to let go of things that drive our individual behavior, and we have to be collectively focused on what's best for the young people. And again, that's the most special part of this partnership, is that's exactly what's happening nationally and in the states that are involved.
Margaret, we couldn't agree with her more in terms of the collectively focused activity. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we're in a couple hundred school-based health centers with clinicians, and we know the value of this. So thank you so much, Marie. Let me follow up with you, though, because this initiative builds on the success in learning from Public Health AmeriCorps program, a $200 million partnership with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We know about that program, but I'm wondering if you could just fill our audience in.
Yeah, so this work comes out of quite a lot of innovation that's happening around national service. So it includes some work that the Schultz Family Foundation pioneered in several states that work to connect the national service year with an actual career and a credential, so that a young person serving for the year could go on to get a family wage supporting job, a credential that has value in the marketplace after their term of service. And then to really think about where you can serve and make a difference tied to public health. And so that is where Public Health AmeriCorps came from. And that was in the wake of COVID and recognizing the capacity challenges in community-based organizations, and pairing those types of organizations up with an AmeriCorps member, so that to expand the potential impact of those organizations. And so wildly successful, and we're excited to have that as one of the inputs to the Youth Mental Health Corps. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fantastic. And I have a feeling one of the conversations around the table with all your partners has to be about the outcomes that you're seeing. And so we would really welcome, whether you have the outcomes already or you have a design to collect the outcomes, what are you seeing in terms of impact? And I guess that would be in two directions, the impact on the young people that the volunteers are working with, and of course, the impact themselves on their lives as they master these skills and do this work.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. That's been an important part of our design. I think we really want to measure that on an ongoing basis, both in terms of sharing the impact with our stakeholder community, but also continuing to refine the design in a way that we have growth in our impact year over year. So in terms of the impact on those serving, we have done a pre and post survey and will do another survey 6 months from now to really understand what was the value add of the experience for the actual youth mental health core members. So we don't yet have that data. I think the second of the three surveys is in the field right now. So more to come on that point. But the other thing we did was worked with WestEd, Elise mentioned this earlier, and we asked them if they could, during this first year, very early on, could they do a set of case studies, one in each of our four states that were with us in this pilot year, and that's Texas, Colorado, Minnesota, and Michigan, and dig in at a site and really start to understand what the impact is of having a youth mental health core member at that site. And they went to different sites. They went to a middle school in Colorado. They went to a community health center in Minnesota, in a very small town in northern Minnesota. And then they went to an organization, I want to say Grand Rapids, Michigan. And what they found very early, we'll have the full report ready later this summer, but what they found was that when you have a youth core member in your school, especially, you saw improved attendance, fewer behavioral incidents, and increased student awareness of mental health and help-seeking behavior. So again, oftentimes the issues facing our young people is social isolation and feeling they're the only ones that are experiencing this. And teaching young people the power of seeking help, having conversations with others, we know is very powerful. So we're excited about those early findings and much more to come. But I think one of the challenges of the behavioral health workforce is that the workforce design itself wasn't allowing for a continuum of professionals to match the continuum of mental health experiences or challenges a young person was facing. And so what we've seen is, as part of just even building out a youth mental health core, states are really thinking about how do we rethink our strategy around behavioral health? How do we begin to offer credentials and career pathways that recognize that, yes, we need psychologists and psychiatrists and masters in social work to deal with more acute cases, but we also need other times for young people to intervene, to begin to have conversations or direct them to resources, even when as a preventative measure, before they even get to those more acute cases. And I feel like, again, Elise has just been an evangelist on this point, is really understanding the youth mental health core as prevention as much as actually addressing acute need now. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Elise.
Yeah, this has sort of been my biggest sticking point. Having previously worked in education policy, one thing I know is that we tend to really focus on, you know, sort of once a young person is in a tier one or tier two level of crisis, then the system sort of kicks in to intervene and ensure that they've got those wraparound supports for them and their families. But, you know, we sort of leave the rest of that general population to sort of figure out how to navigate to the right set of resources on their own. So we're really thinking about how do we go upstream? How do we get to young people before they're in a period of crisis so that they understand and have access to even the language of mental health and emotional well-being and understand the network of resources and supports and services that are available to them in their communities. The other thing is, you know, one thing that the data shows us is that it is difficult for young people to trust educators, parents, when you are in adolescenthood and navigating yourself and the world around you, having someone trusted in your life who has been there very recently can make a very big difference. Yeah. So these young people, these youth mental health core members, we are not training them to supplant any role. They are, you know, obviously not at a period of being a licensed clinician, but we are certainly making sure that they are getting the right training and have access to those additional supports and licensed experts in their community to be able to route those resources to young people in need. But, you know, having a young person to serve as a safe harbor, someone who has just very recently been there and navigated the very same issues that the teens that they're working with are grappling with, can be quite transformative.
our audience is pretty knowledgeable, but I just want to remind them that AmeriCorps is facing significant challenges to its future. It's really fighting for its survival in the courts. A federal judge has blocked some of the budget cuts, not all of the changes. I'm wondering, isn't this a great model, though, AmeriCorps and the Schultz efforts, foundation there, private sector working for public, isn't that an exemplar model of how private sector and government can work together, Marie?
Definitely. I mean, we think it's an amazing model. We built it purposefully at the state level, recognizing obviously these challenges are local, and we want states to have the opportunity to design what the Youth Mental Health Corps looks like to meet the needs of their state. And we also recognize that credentials and career pathways in the behavioral health space are the purview of states. And so this is a state-led initiative. But as you noted, it is braided with philanthropic, private, and public dollars. Both that gives us an opportunity to innovate and scale and sustain this work. And so we, as I mentioned earlier, are bullish on multi-sector partnerships. And we think public sector plays as a critical role, as does the philanthropic and private sectors.
Well, that is very well said. And I think a good note to close on. Thank you, Marie and Elise, for joining us. And thank you to our audience for being here.
That was the Conversations on Healthcare discussing youth mental health corps, still in its early stages, but showing signs that are encouraging: better attendance, fewer behavioral issues, and a growing awareness among students as communities search for innovative solutions. Peer support may be one of the most powerful tools we have. And our thanks to Conversations on Healthcare and its host, Margaret Flintner and Mark Maselli. Still to come on Main Street, Dave Thompson and I will sort through the headlines of this week's news. A powerful story from Harvest Public Media about how tribal lands were once stolen but now reclaimed. And Matt Olean reviews the movie Friendship. It dives into suburban loneliness with equal parts awkward laughs and quiet heartbreak. That's still ahead on Main Street. Stay with us.
The FM Kicks Band presents summer big band concerts at Gooseberry Park in Moorhead on June 19th at 7 p.m., showcasing the sound of jazz for 50 years. Details at fmkicksband.com.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
And we welcome the man who tells our entire state the stories each and every day here on Prairie Public, our veteran news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
Let's review, Dave, this week's news. First story, we can call it a one-stop shop. The state has begun efforts to create this single portal. Tell us more.
Okay, this is something that actually Governor Burgum came up with. He wanted one website, which basically you can log on and say, I want to go to get a fish license or a game license, or maybe start a business. I need some things from commerce. So they've started it, and they've started it with, you know, a focus on business. So you've got Job Service North Dakota, workers' compensation, commerce, that it basically you can think about it like a mall. You go to a mall, but you can still go to the individual stores. So that's what they're trying to do at this website.
They're trying to get the teens to come to the website if it's mall related, right, Dave?
Probably, pretty much, yes.
Dave, Concordia and NDSU have come to a partnership agreement aimed at addressing a pharmacist shortage. First, I didn't know there was a pharmacist shortage. And what will the agreement do?
I didn't know either, but apparently Concordia is going to probably do some of the lower level work, you know, the bachelor's degrees, and NDSU will be the doctorates and the other postgrad degrees. So it's a way to, you know, get more pharmacists into the system in North Dakota. I guess, you know, I'd only heard anecdotally that there was a shortage of pharmacists in North Dakota, but it apparently is real, and the two institutions are stepping up to do something about it.
Okay. Dave, the PSC has rejected here a power line decision, but a route still needs approval. What's the latest there?
So this is what happened. The Public Service Commission has approved a certificate of public convenience and necessity called a PCNN, and basically has done all the due diligence, but the route has not been applied for. And this group of landowners in the region between Jamestown and Ellendale came to the PSC and filed a petition to have them reopen the discussion about the PCNN. Well, they said they ran out of time because, you know, they only had so much time to appeal it. But they said if you do object to the route, well, they haven't actually formally asked for the route yet. That's the time that you're going to be able to file an objection and a petition to deny.
Dave, a group of state and local officials has now called upon Congress to end tax credits for carbon sequestration programs. And North Dakota is one of those states, which surprises me some in that I always viewed this as a way to maybe extend the oil industry.
Absolutely. And I think yet North Dakota is not unanimous in wanting this done because the governor, Kelly Armstrong, has said carbon sequestration is a good thing for North Dakota, and 45Q is going to help make it happen. That's the federal tax break. This was apparently a couple of Democratic lawmakers have said, let's end this tax break. But if you're looking at the majority of elected officials, I do believe they're still for a tax break for carbon sequestration.
Dave, the Army Corps of Engineers is upgrading Garrison Dam spillway after historic flooding that was back in 2011. What's the latest there?
I'll tell you what, I remember that 2011 flood very well. And I think we've talked about it earlier that at the same time you had flooding in Bismarck because of the huge amount of releases coming from the Garrison Reservoir or Lake Sakakawea, plus you had flooding in Minot. Now, they had used some spillways that had never been used before. And there was some damage to that because of just the amount of water that came out of the spillways. So now they have to do some repair work on that, and that's what the money is going for. But I'll never forget going up there and hearing the rumble of the water from that spillway. It was just amazing.
Dave, what are you and your team working on?
I have got a special thing that I'm working on for next week. And this has to do with, you know, it's teacher contract negotiations time. And what we have here is I've talked to a number of the larger school boards and talked about how negotiations have fared, given the fact that they were expecting more money for schools from the legislature and didn't get it. So I think you're going to hear some interesting comments on that.
Very important story to the state and to our state students, Dave. Thanks for reviewing the news with us. We visit with Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public, every week here on Main Street. Dave, enjoy the weekend.
Thank you, Craig. I sure will.
I'll tell you a story.
The fanfare greets us. We know, of course, that it's Thursday. In studio with me is Matt Olean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
The movie today is Friendship, kind of a surreal, cringe-fueled comedy, I guess it's been described as. We'll talk about it in just a moment. Let's listen to the trailer.
Hello?
Howdy.
Howdy.
Honey, the new neighbor invited you over for a drink at 8 tonight. I said you'd go.
You don't know my schedule.
You sit there every night. Might be nice to have a pal, you know, a bud.
Hey, guys, this is my neighbor, Craig. He's the best.
I was just spiraling. I mean, I see the way the guys look at her. I'm scared.
Sheila's lucky to have a dad like you.
Boy, you should know that I've got you on my mind. Your secret admirer. I've been watching you.
At night, I think of you. I want to be your baby.
If your game is on, give me a call, boo. If your love is strong,
I can see the future. It's full of pals. I'm on the edge of life, and the view is gorgeous.
Look, we had a couple of really nice hangs, but I think it best that we go our separate ways. I don't wish to continue this friendship.
Accepted me way too fast. You can't do that.
You made me feel too free. People need rules.
You should be dead, you psycho! Who are you?
Give me a second chance. Get to know me.
There's a new Marvel out that's supposed to be nuts. We should go see that.
All right, Matt, this movie explores male loneliness and misplaced identity, awkward obsession with one suburban man. What did you think of the show?
I did not like it at all. I know some of the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes are good. I mean, and I'll just say this. There's reviewers on Rotten Tomatoes that shouldn't be reviewing movies, in my opinion. I don't know what kind of film knowledge they have, but it's, you know, I just wonder what they're looking at. I saw the movie. There were some people laughing. This is a very black comedy, and comedy, as you know, Craig, is very subjective. It is possibly the most subjective, along with like music. It's just people either respond to it or they don't. It is about a suburban man who's, you know, got a pretty good job. He's played by Tim Robinson, who's kind of a actor and comedian of note that has some podcasts and some TV shows. I was not familiar with him. And he kind of accidentally befriends Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd is a neighbor who plays this TV weatherman who kind of comes off like he's an adventurous spirit, and he tries to get Tim Robinson's character to kind of do some crazy things. They have a sequence where they go down into these tunnels that lead to the city hall, and they explore things, and he loses his phone, and Paul Rudd's like, you don't need your phone, you know? Well, it's one of these where Tim Robinson, his character, needs a friend, and he latches on to Paul Rudd early on. If you've seen the trailer, and of course we just played the trailer for our listeners, he latches on to him in kind of an obsessive way. He thinks he's kind of cool, and he likes his friends. He hangs out with his friends, but it's a black comedy, so things go crazily downhill for Tim Robinson and his life. And, you know, eventually, if you can, you know, we heard the trailer, Paul Rudd kind of turns on him. And I think the film needed to be even darker than it was to make it funny. I did not respond to the humor. It feels like a series of sketches from director Andrew DeYoung. And, you know, Rudd was a producer on the movie. Tim Robinson is an interesting guy to look at on screen. I'll try to say this as nicely as I can. In the movie, his wife is played by Kate Mara. I cannot imagine these two people being married. If this was real life, Tim Robinson would not be married to Kate Mara. I'll just put that out there right there. They're having marital problems in the movie. So that's the first thing that's a little unrealistic. I also wasn't sure, like, what town are we in? What state are we in? It's a very minimalist filmmaking that kind of takes place in this one suburban block, and I really didn't get a sense of a city that they were in. It's obviously a city big enough where Paul Rudd would be a on-air weathercaster, but I didn't think that was very well fleshed out as well. But bottom line is, I did not respond to Tim Robinson as an actor or a comedian, and if you don't, this film will not work. And I know, Craig, you mentioned that your wife saw this movie and didn't care for it either. And maybe
three thumbs down, I think.
Maybe it's his persona that you don't, you're not really sure if what he's doing is funny or creepy or a little of both, but it does not work for me. And I just don't understand the 65% positive Rotten Tomatoes review on this movie. It is not making a lot of money. It was briefly at the Fargo Theater. That's where I saw it. I think it might be a generational thing, Craig, because there were some younger men in the theater that were laughing out loud at some of this stuff, and I just did not find it funny, and I'm not a prude. It wasn't like it was overly, you know, like a black comedy that's too dark. It wasn't anything like that. I just didn't believe hardly any of it from the start, and it just really, it's a very short movie, and it never quite got its sea legs under it.
You know, when you mentioned it, it's a comedy, but I've also read where it's really kind of sad. And the tagline to the movie is essentially, men shouldn't have friends. Is it sad in that way?
You know, it's supposed to be sad, but at the end, I was just glad the movie was over. I didn't feel anything for this guy. This guy is a schlep. He's a loser. I mean, and it's all kind of done. He kind of does it to himself. So I didn't feel any real sadness for the Tim Robinson character. I think it needed to be developed more for us to really feel something for this guy. It's played for very broad laughs, but as I said, I wasn't sure whether to laugh or not laugh in some of these scenes, and maybe I'm not the target audience here. I think the demographic for this movie is males in their 20s, probably, but it didn't work for me.
Let's move to the Oscar trivia part of our show. Matt, who won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in 2022?
The actor in Coda.
Troy Kotsur.
Troy Kotsur.
There you go. We've been to the movies with our great movie reviewer, Matt Olien. Matt, what's coming down the road for our movie reviews?
Well, we've got The Life of Chuck, director Mike Flanagan's new movie. I'll review that next week. And then July 10th, we'll have F1 with Brad Pitt and Javier Bardem. So those are the next two.
I'm looking forward to
hearing. I'm excited about that one. Yep.
What you have to say about that? We go to the movies every Thursday with Matt Olien.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation was promised land in Illinois nearly two centuries ago, but the United States government sold it illegally to white settlers. Now, after decades of effort and over $10 million spent, the tribe has reclaimed part of that land, including a state park named for their ancestor, Chief Chabanais, as we hear in this report from Harvest Public Media.
Raphael Wawusik drives through Chief Chabanais Forest Preserve in northern Illinois. He's a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi's Tribal Council and a direct descendant of the chief, whose name the Prairie Band pronounces Chabanais.
If this is accurate, that this was the site where his cabin was, then within a few hundred yards, you know, I've got some family members that are buried out in these woods here.
The Prairie Band were removed from Illinois in the 19th century, and their reservation's now in Kansas. But in 2024, the federal government put land the tribe purchased in trust, making the Prairie Band Illinois' first federally recognized tribal nation. And this year, they got even more land back when Illinois passed a law transferring ownership of the neighboring Chabanais Lake State Park to the tribe.
You know, my family have been coming up here for almost the two centuries since we've been forced out. And to see that happen in my lifetime is something that I thought I would never experience.
Recently, other Midwest tribes have successfully gotten land back through various means. Just last year, Minnesota returned a state park to the Dakota tribe, and Congress passed a law returning land to the Winnebago in Iowa. Kevin Washburn served as Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs in the Obama administration and is a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. And he says that while the movement has gotten more public attention lately, it is not new.
Tribes have been wanting their land back probably since before the ink was dried on the original treaties where they ceded that land.
And tribes lost even more land after the Dawes Act in 1887, which broke commonly owned reservations into individual parcels. In the allotment era, about 65% of reservation land fell out of Native hands. And today, tribes own around 60 million acres across the U.S., which is about the size of the state of Oregon. And while some have had land returned by states and the federal government, Washburn says that is not the norm.
The most common way that tribes get land back is they go out and buy the land.
Many tribes have made buying land back a priority. Nicole Rummel is with the United Nations Land Management Department. They're a tribe just outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
In 82, that's when the tribe approved every carton of cigarettes being sold. 30 cents of that went to land acquisition. So that's really what started money going back into being able to buy land.
They now operate a casino as well, and they've been able to purchase back nearly half of the reservation land they lost. But tribes can face other challenges even when they can purchase land. In 2023, when the federal government put 500 acres of land the United Nation owned into trust, a Wisconsin village sued in part because of lost tax revenue. The case is in federal court. And sometimes people take advantage of how important it is for tribes to restore their homelands. Matthew Wiesaw is the tribal chair of the Pokagon Band Potawatomi, which has land in Michigan and Indiana.
One of the biggest difficulties is when people find out it's the Pokagon Band that's looking to purchase the land, the price gets really jacked up. So we have to deal with that. So we have to do a lot of stuff under the cover of different entities.
Wiesaw says they don't buy land just to buy land. They focus on sacred places like old villages, historic sites, and burial grounds. And back in Illinois, Raphael Wawusik looks out across Chabanais Lake, which was once part of a Prairie Band village. And even though the tribe was forced off this land so long ago, he says he still feels a strong connection to this place. His family always has.
For me, I didn't need the piece of paper to really drive that home. That's something that has been instilled in me since I was a young boy, that this is part of our home as well.
And as the land back movement picks up steam, he hopes more tribes will be able to return to their ancestral homes. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Peter Mudlin.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 19th. The celebration of fathers dates back centuries. In Catholic countries of Europe, a day honoring fathers has been celebrated at least since 1508. Fathers are recognized on St. Joseph's Day, which falls on March 19th. Many countries around the world have set aside a day to honor fathers. Father's Day in the United States was the idea of Sonora Smart Dodd. Her father was a twice-married, twice-widowed Civil War veteran, and the father of 14 children. After Mother's Day was established in 1908, she had the idea to create a similar holiday for fathers. The story goes that during her church's Mother's Day service in 1909, Dodd thought about her father. She said, "He was both father and mother to me and my brothers and sisters." She believed that mothers deserved recognition, but so did fathers. Dodd brought her idea to churches, businessmen, the YMCA, and government officials. She brought a request to the Spokane Ministerial Alliance, asking them to dedicate a Sunday to recognize fathers. The local clergy liked the idea. They settled on June 19th, the third Sunday in June. The state of Washington held an official Father's Day event on that day in 1910. Not everyone embraced the idea. Many men scoffed at what they saw as sentimental attempts to domesticate manliness with flowers and gift-giving. In the 1920s, a movement arose to scrap both Mother's and Father's Day in favor of Parents' Day. Supporters of Parents' Day rallied in Central Park in New York City. One activist said, "Both parents should be loved and respected together." Father's Day might have remained a local event, but Dodd pressed on to make it a national holiday. In spite of early resistance, the idea gradually caught on across the country. William Jennings Bryan, one of the most famous orators of the time, wrote to Dodd and expressed his support. In 1916, President Wilson pressed a button on a telegraph in Washington, D.C. that unfurled a flag in Spokane, Washington. In 1924, President Calvin Coolidge urged state governments to observe Father's Day. Dodd's efforts finally paid off. In 1972, 6 years before her death, President Richard Nixon signed a congressional resolution declaring the third Sunday in June to be Father's Day. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy's topic this week is the philosophical middle. And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again next Monday right back here on Main Street.